I welcome you to session 154, Mormonism and the Prosperity Gospel. Our speaker today is John Larson. But before I introduce him, I remind you to turn off your cell phones and other devices that might make noises during our session. The session will be recorded, and the questions that you might have after the session, you need to come up close to the table because there are no mics that will extend back to reach any sound farther than about the first row. John Larson got his BA in linguistics from Brigham Young University and wanted to merge the anthropological sciences with computing methodologies and the analysis of language. And he pursued an MBA here at Weber State University, where he emphasized computing and software. And he currently works as project manager overseeing the work of software programmers. He is currently the board chairman of the Post-Mormon Foundation, and he is director and host of the Mormon Expression podcast, which has recently completed its 150th interview, or pardon me, episode, and has interviewed and has, over 5,000 subscribers. So with that introduction, we'll turn the time over to John, and we'll let him, after he concludes his presentation, simply invite questions from the audience or comments from the audience. But again, so I won't come up again, but if you have anything to contribute, please come up close to the table because of the microphone that it will be able to pick up your question or comment.
Well, thanks. Doing a podcast, you get used to not talking to people. You're always staring at a screen, so this is sort of different for me. I haven't given a sacramentum talk in a while, so you'll forgive me if I'm off kilter a little bit. A couple years ago, I heard an interview on the radio, and like most things that I've heard, I forgot anything useful about it. I can't tell you who it was or what it was about. But these researchers had been investigating criminals. They'd gone through the prison system, and they'd interviewed people who'd done all sorts of different crimes, from white-collar crimes down to the other color crimes, whatever that is. They wanted to find out what was the common factor among criminals. I mean, was it greed? Was it whatever? And what they came away with was the one thing that was common to all these guys serving time was a strong sense of entitlement. People who committed a lot of crimes believed that they were entitled to whatever it was that they eventually took, whatever they stole. For whatever reason, it was just theirs, and they could have it, and that's what gave them the moral justification to do whatever action. Similarly, in business school, pretty much came to the same conclusion. That's what drives the business industry too. And as you look at the way people stratify in business, and we'll get into that in a little bit more, there does get to be a strong sense of entitlement and square inches in the office and the chairs we sit on, we're going to come back to that one too, become a very big differentiator and something that people go from very quickly from getting a promotion to thinking, wow, I have all this stuff, to this is mine and this is what I'm supposed to have. The reason I bring that up, we're going to talk about the prosperity gospel. It's also known as prosperity theology and health and wealth. It's really something, an idea that's been growing in America for quite some time, but really took off after the war and is strongly followed among charismatics, Pentecostals, evangelicals. And that's where you'll see most of the driving force behind it. So today we want to explore that idea a little bit, find out what sort of motivates our evangelical brethren, and then kind of compare and contrast that to Mormonism. But I do want to go back, Pentecostalism and evangelical belief has sort of some of the same foundations as Mormonism. They both came from Christianity, and they both were born in America, and were fundamentally American ideas, which is why I think sort of feeds that sense of entitlement that is behind the prosperity theology. In a nutshell, prosperity theology is that God wants you to be happy, and He wants you to be successful. And He will bless your life materially if you follow Him. and that those blessings will follow his believers. In America, there's a couple ideas. Of course, the American dream, you've all heard about in school, which was a term coined by James Adams, an author, in his 1931 book, The Epic of America, which is just that America is so much better and so much richer than every other place, that if you come here and you work hard and you do your best, then you will be blessed materially. You will be able to succeed. And there's a reverse to that idea you see bleed out in the culture all the time, which is those who don't have that sort of blessing, those who are poor, are that way because of some flaw in their character or some flaw in their action. They're lazy. So that idea you see time and time again in American culture. That's been around for a long time. There's another sort of more sinister cousin of that idea, which is American exceptionalism. American exceptionalism is just the idea that America is very much special and different than every other place. And for religious people, it becomes sort of, it imbues it with this religious sort of, we'll talk about Joseph Smith in a little bit, but that America is this place that's more blessed by God, and it's where his ideas and his, meaning God, his views for the world are taking seed, and it's our responsibility as Americans to go out to the world and by sword or by tract to bring them to the right way of thinking. And you will hear these sort of ideas of American exceptionalism all the time, especially from congressmen. They say this stuff flat out. But it's an idea that's been around for quite some time. Now, when we get to the war period, you know, the World War II, everybody comes home in 1945, and America has emerged sort of victorious and the clear, you know, world leader in terms of economics and production and all sorts of other things. And I think people wanted to retreat a little bit from the horrors of the war. And there was sort of this retreat into materialism, our little pink houses that we started building all over the country, and everybody becoming more prosperous than the generation before. And that is the age that gave rise to these this prosperity gospel. One of the first proponents of it was, you've all heard of Oral Roberts, who started out as a Pentecostal faith healer. Now, when we talk about Pentecostalism and the evangelicals, one of the things that's really important to them is a direct manifestation of God's love and God's acceptance of you in your life. So for them, the conversion experience is a very is something that's really palpable and something that's really felt and understood. You're really going to feel God's love, and you're going to feel different. You're going to feel set apart. And those sort of things started to come out in some of the Pentecostal churches and things in some of the like more remote ones, like snake handling, you know, where you can show that God is blessing you because you can do all these miraculous things. And faith healers and that sort of stuff, because once again, you're seeing God's direct intervention, God's material sort of interaction with you as a believer. And that's why in those movements, healing and being healed and that health prosperity becomes very important. Well, obviously that starts to bleed over into the materialism. And for our friend Oral Roberts, he became one of the pioneering televangelists. So the televangelists were very interesting because they really jumped the boundary of the churches. Where before you would go to this church on this corner or this church on this corner. But now anybody from anywhere can watch them, and they're putting the money in, and the money is rolling in. And I mean, everybody's seen the cliches of the, you know, the gold Rolexes and all that sort of material sort of signs that the televangelists would cling to. So this is sort of the genesis. And there were other organizations among the loose coalitions. One that's oftentimes bantied about is an organization called World of Faith, where a lot of the churches get together and talk about prosperity and that sort of thing. Probably the leader of it in our generation is a guy named Joel Osteen, I think is how you pronounce his name. He wrote a book in 2004 called Your Best Life Now, Seven Steps to Living at Your Full Potential. And this thing has sold millions of copies. I went down to Barnes & Noble to pick up a copy, and they didn't have any, but they had the workbook, and they had the calendar, and they had the chicken soup for the seven. You know, they had like all the spin-off books from this one book. And he's written several. And if you look at the book, you've got the number seven in there, the Covey magic number, right? So you've got this faith merging with sort of that, I don't know, New Age business bookshelf stuff that they've got into, hey, you can go out there and you can achieve, you can grab these things. We're going to give you some easy to digest principles for doing that. Sorry, that's a little cynical, but so that's sort of what the book is. He has a church still in Northeast Houston. It's America's largest church. It routinely attracts over 30,000 people to a service. That's one service. I think the basketball stadium down at BYU has 26,000 seats. So you can think about that thing being full plus another 5,000 people. That's how many people are attending church. And, you know, they don't pay 10%, but still, there's a lot of money rolling in there. Here's a quote. This came from Business Week, I believe. Business Week, May 23rd, 2005. The interviewer asked him this question. Some of your critics say that your so-called prosperity gospel isn't in keeping with the traditional Christian message, which has often been suspicious of material wealth. How do you respond? And here's Joel's response. I believe that God's dream is that we be successful in our careers and that we be able to send our kids to college. I don't mean that everyone is going to be rich, and I preach a lot on blooming where you're planted, but I don't have the mindset that money is a bad thing. My views may go against some of the older traditional teachings, but I think we should have a mindset that God wants us to prosper in our relationships, our health, and our finances. God's desire is that we excel, and we see business leaders who are good, strong Christians running big companies. And you'll recall about this time the book was published, you know, Jesus is the perfect CEO or something like that. So you get a lot of that CEO mindset who were also touting their Christian belief. And this gave that perfect merger because here you have sort of a justification of whatever wealth or whatever material trappings you have if God wants you to be there. Now let's kind of go back in time and sort of explore some of the foundations that these guys cling to. Of course, for those who read the New Testament, it does seem sort of paradoxical. When I first read the New Testament when I was 18, I sort of shifted my political leanings from being on the right to the left just from reading the book. It doesn't affect everybody that way, but it did me. So a lot of people criticize the prosperity gospel and say, well, don't you guys read what Jesus says about, you know, rendering to Caesar and, you know, all that sort of stuff? But if you go back in time a little bit further, the Old Testament really doesn't have a lot to say about the afterlife. It really has more to do about, you know, the tribe and the people that it's dealing with. But there is a certain notion of, you know, God will bless your flocks and God will bless your manservant, your maidservant. And there is a manifestation that if you're obeying God's will as a people, then you will conquer your enemies. You know, and it's still a very Bronze Age sort of book. But, I mean, that's the same idea that kind of resurfaces again and again. So the scriptures that the evangelicals quote all the time, they quote Malachi 3:10, which says, bring the whole tithe into the storehouse so there may be food in my house and test me. If I will not open for you the windows of heaven and pour out your blessings until overflows. There's a similar scripture in Deuteronomy. The two that I think are interesting come from the New Testament. One is John 10:10. I have come that they may have life and that they may have it more abundantly. And of course, if you're a materialist, more abundant life means, I guess, more TVs and cars and houses and stuff like that. And 3 John 2, Beloved, I pray that you may prosper in all things and be in health, just as your soul prospers. So these are scriptures that you can find in their writings from the prosperity gospel evangelicals. I think there's another idea that has been floating around that is really important because I think it surfaces again in Mormonism. And that is the divine right of kings. Now, the divine right of kings was used, well, it's been around for a long, long time. But the gist of the idea is that we're all subservient to a higher master. You know, I'm a serf, and there's my baron. But he ultimately comes in to the king. And the king is not beholden to anybody except God. So just like the king could remove me from my barony, or, you know, my account could remove me from my whatever humble mud hut that I have, God can remove the king at any time he wants to. So the fact that God has not removed the king, ergo, God is in favor of whatever the king is doing. You'll see this sort of language pop up here in a few years when the queen dies. There'll be a lot of this sort of thing that's still there in our society. And it does, it's a theme that pops up in the scriptures over and over. which is simply to state that the state of, it's sort of a backwards take on the theodicy, right? The state of being could be changed by God. God chooses not to change it. Therefore, the state of being is endorsed by God. And it's mostly used by people who want to stay in power. But it's an idea that has a lot of power. So simply, if God wants to change it, he can change it. Now, let's dip into Mormonism for a little bit. You know, if we look at the history of the Smiths, and taking that American dream, were very much a part of that sort of zeitgeist. They were moving from farm to farm, pursuing the better thing. As they pushed west into Indian territory, former Indian territory, like so many other people were doing, and they were, you know, starting from ground zero and going to build their farm and going to build their little cake and beer shop or whatever it was that they were doing. They were pursuing that American dream. And from the very foundation, as the Smiths moved from city to city, from Kirtland to Missouri and then on to Nauvoo, you see that same building, and we'll talk about that in a second. But I just want to point out that even from the treasure digging to the legitimate trying to build prosperity, that idea was fundamental and foundational to the Smith family and the foundation of the church. Of course, in 1830, Joseph Smith publishes the Book of Mormon. And the Book of Mormon has an interesting take on this whole thing, because the Book of Mormon has what I think even the Sunday school manual is called the prosperity cycle, which is that the people, once they become righteous and once they serve God, will become rich and be blessed with all sorts of material trappings. But the Book of Mormon says at that point, the people become prideful and the people become ripe for destruction. And then God will raise up some sort of other to come and humble the righteous, and they will be brought down again, only to then repeat the cycle. As they become righteous again, they will become rich. The interesting thing about the idea in the Book of Mormon is it's not really clear if it is inherent in the system or if it's imposed. Like, does it just imply, as a lot of Mormons would say, that if you are righteous, wealth will follow after you because you'll be making good choices, and good choices lead to better crops and better whatever else you get to. So there's sort of a fatalistic take in the book which says this is sort of an eternal cycle that nobody ever breaks out of, because it's inevitable that when you come to the top, you're gonna come back to the bottom. Of course, the other take is the one that I implied, which is it's God who gets sort of upset. The people are at the top, and then sends somebody else in to humble them. Either way, it's still there. So you can kind of take either take. You can justify either behavior using the Book of Mormon. You can say, oh, look, here's this prosperity, therefore we're doing God's will. Here's a sign of our righteousness. Or, hey, we're getting too rich. There's a sign of our imminent corruption. We need to rein it in a bit. Of course, right from the early stages, you know, Joseph Smith designates Zion there outside of Kansas City in Missouri, and lays out this plot map, which has a big, huge, beautiful city, which has 24 temples. I mean, it's something that's not like a small group of mud huts or whatever. They're really thinking big, and as we look to build Kirtland and we look to build Nauvoo, we're always sort of looking over the horizon and incorporating that material wealth. And you know, the early stages of the United Order were sort of defined out in a take care of the poor. And there were problems they ran into inherent in that sort of economic system. If you try to redistribute wealth, there's certain problems that you can learn about in high school with that. And they sort of retrenched and pulled back from that a little bit. And in Kirtland, you have more of a standard American model of, you know, property development and property speculation. And of course, maybe if there hadn't been the collapse that happened all over the United States, they would have ridden through that. But there was a lot of that speculation that was driven by an idea that this was all okay, this was all good, that we can buy low and sell high to the next group of saints that are coming in, and that idea was perfectly acceptable all the way around. And we even saw in Nauvoo there were, you know, disputes between the upper area where the temple was and the lower flats, where as immigrants started going, there was price competition between church authorities and some bad blood that arose from that. There was underlying that whole thing still that this property speculation is okay, and it's part of building the kingdom of God. Now, Brigham Young, who was, if not anything, pragmatic, when the Saints came back to Utah and they had to start over from scratch. Now, anybody who's ever played like one of those games online, like SimCity, you'll know you can't build your commerce before you build your industry, right? And the Mormons learned that very quickly. And I think that might have been more some of the problem. I'm not an economist, so. But, you know, in Kirtland, you try to get ahead of yourself too much with commerce, and it tends to collapse. You have to have those sustaining industries. And Brigham Young and his advisors understood that very quickly, which is why there was a very early scramble in the whole Salt Lake Valley to control the natural resources. You know, one of the, according to Arrington, one of the settlement strategies for Brigham Young was he was trying to get Saints on every natural spring along the up and down corridor so that no Gentiles could come in and establish a bulkhead so that the Mormons controlled the whole corridor. So you couldn't really move up and down the corridor, and that would be all the way down to California, right, without having to interact with the Mormons and without having them to control that, which was both an economic shrewd decision, but it was a mechanism of protection, which is what they were worried about at the time. They wanted to build Zion literally. They for Brigham Young and his guys, and back to Joseph Smith, the millennium was something we were going to build ourselves into. We were going to build the kingdom of God, and that meant really building it. I mean, planting the crops and laying out the roads, and it was a very literal thing. And for them, the gathering was not something that was abstract at all. So those ideas, as we take that tight control that Brigham Young had in the early 1850s, where if you wanted to go up to this canyon and cut wood, you needed to get the church and Young and the 12, you need to get their sort of permission, because they divvied out all those controls very early on. Of course, as the railroads came through and the Gentiles came through, it's very hard for the Mormons to keep that level of control. But that system of we are building God's work, and everything from mining to timber cutting to planting our crops is all part of God's plan for us and all part of what we're doing, is an idea that never just like stopped. It slowly grew and evolved, into the Zion's Mercantile Exchange, and then on and on and on to what we have, to what we still have today, where the church still has tons of holdings. You know, if you go out in West Valley, about 4 miles south of the airport, there's a big, huge industrial development called Lake Park. It's got a golf course or two around it, and there's some headquarters for like Discover Card. IEC is headquartered there, so they're big Class A business buildings. That is all owned by the church. So you can make an argument with like the downtown mall that the church has a vested interest in keeping its properties sort of holy by not having undesirables around there, but the Lake Park is purely an industrial or a commercial enterprise. I don't know how you could make a connection between that and religion, other than that's just what the church has always done. It's always had its hands in those sort of things. You know, there's a lot of, especially critics of the church, who try to suggest that the mall downtown with its whatever price tag. I mean, I hear a lot of numbers, and they get bigger all the time. I don't know that I trust any of them. But you know, there's a lot of people say, "Oh, why are they spending the tithing on this?" My response is, you don't understand the church's outside holdings. I doubt they have to spend any tithing on that, because they still have a lot of interest all over in things that you would have no idea they were in. And I don't really say that as a matter to blame them, because these guys inherited that system from the guys who inherited that system from the guys who inherited that system. It's been around for a lot of years. So inherent in all this, from the early days of when Joseph Smith first introduced the United Order, was this concept of stewardship, which is a very important idea to understand Mormons and the way they think about this, and which is an idea really from the Bible, I guess. You know, we have the parable of the talents, where each servant is given talents. The expectation is they go and they multiply those talents, that they don't just sit on them, that they go out and grow it. And when you have an economic system merged with a religion like Mormonism is, that's very literal. If they're going to give you an investiture, if they're going to send you to some colony somewhere, you know, they expect you to start. If Brigham Young sends you a bunch of silkworms, he's expecting silk. And then that's the way it was. So that concept of stewardship has always stayed with us, both in religious terms, in the way we divvy out callings, and the way we look at one another. Because we there's a tendency, I believe, in our culture to look at those who multiply their stewardship, whatever that is. i.e. be successful out in the world, as those who are somehow a little bit more righteous, a little bit more on that path. So let's talk about Mormonism today. I think in Mormonism today, the idea of building prosperity, and not just having prosperity, is still key and fundamental. And you can go to Deseret Book and find the Distribution Center. There's still manuals that tell you how to do things like raise rabbits and plant crops and can peaches. So there's still this idea of going beyond. I like to compare Mormonism in this avenue to, say, the Jehovah Witnesses, you know, because they came around about the same time and had some of the same sort of ideas. But for the Jehovah Witnesses, there is very much a push off of wealth, that it's seen as an undesirable thing. And it's also, even pursuing higher education is often seen as undesirable, it's seen as showy. As such, they have not had the material prosperity that the LDS Church has had, although their numbers are quite fairly equivalent. But when you encourage your members not to get money, they tend not to get money, and then you don't get that in your coffers. So that idea of prosperity and building prosperity and making things beautiful is still there. Zilpha and I, we moved back to Utah last year. We lived out in North Carolina. We were on the beach out in Wilmington, very sandy, and the grass does not grow very well out there. But right by the college, there was an LDS ward house. And it looked like it was just dropped there right out of Sandy, Utah. It had Kentucky bluegrass. No one else did. And, you know, the amount of water they must have had to pour on that, because it would just run through the sand. And I'm sure if I went into the closet, and I know exactly where the closet would be, there'd be a snow shovel there, because that's the way it's done, right? But you know, the building was very, very nice, like they are. It was very, very nice and well-coiffed, and all the hedge, and it had the Bowery in the back, and all that kind of stuff. And it was easily the best looking church around, except for some of the really old churches. But you know, they were falling apart. It was very well maintained, and there was very much that show of prosperity there. Where did I put my little paper in there? My church news. So there are still these. I want to go through some of the elements today that you can see where the show of wealth and prosperity, and I should make the point, the prosperity is not just displayed through wealth, it's displayed through success. There is a way people dress, there's a way they act, there's a way they talk, which gives you clues that this person is higher in station. And those are very, very important. And if you go into big companies, like Fortune 500 companies, they will often buy cars and watches and shoes and stuff for their executives, because they want them, especially if they face down other executives, these are things like investment bankers and stuff, to be showing those trappings and those signs of wealth. I believe it or not, I just picked this one random off my stack. This is April 30th, 2011, LDS Church News. If you're in Utah, you're kind of held hostage to subscribing to Deseret News to get this. And, you know, here's they're always putting in the leadership. So here there happens to be a 70, and there are mission presidents. And I think right back here, they're putting in area leadership. So they have the bios. So the question is, what would be interesting in a bio, especially when you only have like a sentence or two? If you go to the Book of Mormon again, and especially the New Testament, you know, the servants of the Lord should be humble, sort of. They're selected because of their religious aptitude, I would assume, or their ability to hold and maintain the priesthood or whatnot. So it's very telling when you don't have very many lines of text what you're going to put in here. So here's one, Mission President Elder Charles Evans, 58, four children, Japan Sapporo Mission. He served as a district president, as former state president, high counselor, bishop, counselor in a bishopric, high priest group leader, and missionary in the Japan Tokyo Mission. Period. Industrial partner, Ripwood Holdings, RHJ International, and former chairman and CEO, D&M Holdings Incorporated. I don't even understand what that means, you know. Then it goes on to say his wife has four kids. So if in each of these, you will see sometimes a line dedicated to, but that when the mission presents come out, oftentimes I've seen where there's nothing about their callings in there. It will only say what they did. And invariably, it is something that indicates that they were an executive. One of them in here, you know, talks about that he was a property investor. So why would you put that? Well, you know, when I wrote my bio for this thing, it's I'm trying to say the things that sort of make me qualified to talk about this. So there is an underlying assumption that business qualifications make you qualified to serve in the gospel. Photography. There's been other sessions at Sunstone years past, and people have done research on this. If you go through the photography that is used in the Ensign and in church publications, they're actually pretty good about trying to, you know, show that the church is diversified racially. Probably the photography is more diversified than the church is. But if you pay attention in the photographs to what's going on behind, you will tend to see they're in middle to upper middle class homes. There are trappings of wealth like grandfather clocks or, you know, so there's this portrayal that those who are right, you know, they're doing their home teaching or they're doing family home evening, that those who are doing the whatever righteous thing they're trying to show in there, there's also this halo of American materialistic success that tends to be around them. Utah, and I apologize, I didn't get the references for these, but I've noticed these come out in the last few years. In the last 3 years, there have been in the newspaper, Utah leads the sale in cosmetics, hair dye, and boob jobs per capita. And one of the reasons is, not that I'm against any of those things, but that there is once again this idea that your outward appearance sort of manifest your prosperity. All these things show are signs of being middle class or upper middle class, that you have the means to, you know, sort of take care of yourself a little bit more. And there gets to be a comparison, because that plays out in the wards. I started watching this about 10 or 15 years ago, and I just invite you, somebody should do the research on this. When there is a stake that has that covers a diversified economic area, the leadership tends to be stratified to the more wealthy portion of that area. And you'll notice that in the high council and especially the stake president. You know, the stake president, in my experience, you know, in 10 or 12 different states, tends to come from the wealthiest neighborhoods. And I think that you know, one of the points I'm getting at here is there's an underlying bias towards that. I don't think it's a conscious thing. I think it's something that we tend to, has been imbued into our culture, so we tend to see it that way. Couple more, because both of these came up in business school. One is, I mentioned at the beginning, is chairs. Chairs, I read a whole paper when I was in business school on chairs and what companies will do. And any company that's a big company, they're very conscious about who is sitting in what chair in their office. The brethren sit in these big red chairs. And on the podcast, every conference we do a conference review where I bring in people to review. Last conference, I brought in an ex-Jehovah Witness who had never seen conference. And the first thing out of his mouth as we were walking out of the chapel was, "What was with those chairs?" Because they're very much a sign of that, you know, it's a throne, for heaven's sakes. I mean, they're showing their authority. And the same goes with the suits. You know, we live in a sort of a meritocracy these days where it's not just the people in charge, but very smart people. If you get to companies where where the brains are the most important things like Google or Pixar, you'll notice that the dress code is not as like important. But in places where there is control of wealth, like stockbrokers and investment bankers and stuff, they dress in a very, very rigid manner. And that's exactly how the brethren choose to dress. Now, for whatever reason there might be culturally behind that, today, that charcoal suit with that dark tie has a specific meaning. And people are going to pick up on that meaning. And whether they like it or not, that's going to be associated with that sort of crowd, with investment bankers. And if you read the brethren, that's who they're picking. They pick lawyers, and they pick businessmen, and they pick CEOs. And then, you know, the last one, I was in San Diego on my mission, when the temple went up. And I'm sure you've all seen the San Diego Temple. If you're going north on I-5, right along the coast, as you go out of San Diego into La Jolla, which is the most expensive neighborhood, San Diego, which is one of the most expensive cities in the United States, in the world probably, you crest this hill, and there it is, like this golden. And there was a lot of pressure. It took them several years to actually get it all permitted because there was a lot of resistance to it. I believe the final price tag was $27 million for it. And just like all the temples, you know, that one is a good example. D.C. is another good example. When you come around the Beltway, and there it is, and they're all lit up. And for a lot of people, they see that as ostentatious display of wealth, that so much, you know, BTUs are used up lighting those things up, and they're very fine, you know, that the church has chosen to display that way. And, you know, it has that cultural meaning. Once again, it's that we're going to sort of try to display our righteousness or our success in terms of the gospel, in terms of this material display. All right, so let's talk about sort of the upside and downside of these beliefs. I think there's a noticeable economic uplift for Mormons. People who get involved in the church and stay involved in the church tend to progress socioeconomically. And, you know, the ranking of BYU's law school and its business school tend to be telling. I call them the two towers, you know, because they're safe, right? There's hardly anything you learn in law or in business that's going to threaten your testimony. So the church feels comfortable pushing success and pushing money that way. But the upside of that is there are a lot of successful LDS people, a lot of dentists. It seems like every city, all the dentists are LDS, and a lot of the doctors and a lot of the lawyers. And so that buoys the socioeconomic state. If that's what you're looking for, it's working. I think that it does do that. I think on the downside, the doctrine probably has a dampening effect on international growth for the church, partly because of where spending goes. And I think there's another side to that, which is the American exceptionalism. That if we build everything really ostentatious in the United States, and we go to third world places where we don't do so much, there can be sort of this, well, why are we pouring all this wealth into the United States? And of course, people like the other industrial sectors, like the Europeans, tend to look at that, and they're not as keen on that thing. It's like, we had 1,500 years of that, and we're done with it, sort of thing. The other effect I've noticed from there is, in my experience, and I've talked to a lot of other people who've served out in the world, the church tends to attract a lot of Amerophiles, people who really like United States business culture and that sort of thing. And the church capitalizes on this. You'll see in Japan or Korea or wherever else, they're always teaching English classes, you know. Well, there's something going on there that since the church and its trappings are so tightly woven with the American trappings of success, those who are attracted to such things may well be attracted to the church. So you're going to have an off-putting effect for some people who look and say, that church is too American. There's going to be another group that says, wow, that church is really American. And I guess the flip side of that is if people see the wealth and they see the wealth displayed in the church publications, they might say, well, that can be me. I guess the next sort of downside is that embracing materialism as a show of righteousness can lead to embracing materialism, period. So you know, how do you differentiate in a ward between the people who have boats because they're righteous, people have boats because they bought a boat? So that starts to intermix, and then you can get some people who are leading the church who might not have the spiritual depth that it takes, an aptitude that it takes to do the job that the bishop or stake president does, because that job is not easy. And then you get the obvious things like we've talked about. I talked about San Diego, the mall, where there's a lot of head scratching going on over the United States for people, you know, like, why would the church build such a mall? I think for those of us raised in the church, and we sort of get it right off the get-go, and that there, it's not that confusing, but it's really hard to articulate to your friends. You're like, well, you know, it's but I think it can be off-putting, really, to a lot of people who would be the target audience. And then you get other halo effects, which I don't think the brethren are fully on board with. They kind of, you know, where the church starts to marry itself with some of the, you know, the right wing views, especially when it comes to, you know, taxes and wealth and that sort of thing. Probably the last downside effect is that I think Mormons who want that same sort of, you know, like let's say, let's put aside the pretense and say you wanted to be a state president. You know, because you're not supposed to want to be a state president. You might say, well, I've got to be a little bit more financially secure. And this might make otherwise honest people more susceptible to things like multi-level marketing. Where I don't think that as a culture that the majority of the Mormons are like fraudulent. I think as a culture the majority of the Mormons are honest and they assume other people are. But I think this idea that, you know, we need to have that sort of trapping to show our outward manifestation or inward state might lead people more susceptible to it. Okay, so let's sort of wrap up and bring back in the where we started with the prosperity gospel. First of all, I just want to say Mormonism is a complex and changing religion. I mean, we're in the early stages of religion when you compare it to, you know, say all the other big world religions. We're still, you know, we haven't even invented monasticism yet, you know, and that's a major part of other religions. So we're still young. So there's going to be elements that adhere to this and not. I mean, there's a lot of people in the church who aren't materialistic, who aren't that way, and I don't mean to try to throw everybody underneath that. I think that wealth always comes at a cost, and there comes at a benefit. A rising tide tends to rise all ships, that we see that there becomes economic prosperity and it grows on itself. But when you buy your tennis shoes, oftentimes it's at an environmental cost. It's in a cost of resources. It's a cost of child or slave labor sometimes. And when we pursue those sort of things, there is a downside to that that can manifest itself in the church and in the individuals. I really think the final to comparison between the two ideas, you know, ultimately, I think they really come from the same source, that American dream, that American exceptionalism, that idea that we're somehow doing everything better than everybody else, therefore our religions are better and our buildings are better and our football teams are better and everything is better here. But I do think there's a sort of a good difference that points to the peculiarity of the Mormon people, and that's that as I was reading through the prosperity sort of stuff, I never got the sense that anybody was saying, see that evangelical guy over there who's a millionaire? Well, I'm evangelical too, therefore we're all better. But I did get that from the Mormons, that the idea that, look at Steve Young. You know, Steve Young is successful. Look at Mitt Romney. Therefore, we're all successful. So there's still this sort of family group about it, that the wealth and success of the stake president or of the bishop or of the guys in the Quorum of the Twelve is shared by us all, and I think that's sort of endearing. So that's the idea. I guess we're open for any questions or comments. Remember, you need to come up here so you can get recorded for posterity. Come on up.
I think that it's conscious, the awareness of this model, because my neighbors went to Nigeria on their mission, and I said, what did you do? And this is what they did. In that particular village, all the people would go out and make money, take care of their needs, and if they had any left, they'd share it with their neighbors. So all the time, their money's gone at the end of the day. Everybody's. We're teaching them not to share with our neighbors at the end of the day and put their money away so they can save it up to build a little business. Sorry. It's conscious.
Well, I definitely, whenever you see a system like this, there are people who are gaming the system.
No, this is directed from above.
Well, I mean, there's that too. There's people who honestly believe that wealth is the way God wants us to be. I mean, that's implicit in the whole thing, you know. And yeah, the direction. Well, we'll save that. Go on.
I have a family member who has recently gotten involved in the multi-level marketing world, specifically attached to a guy named Lennon Ledbetter, who used to work for Amway and is now with Zango, and has these cult-like rah-rah sessions, and I feel like it's just a complete scam and is feeding into this desperation for wealth in Mormonism. Would you care to comment on that?
I actually have fairly personal experience with that. there's a very close relative of mine, and she had a lot of kids when they were still in school, you know, which sort of puts you behind the curve. They never went hungry or anything, but she always felt a strong pull that she had been righteous, she'd been paying her tithing, she'd been sacrificing, and now it was time for her to get a blessing. And I can think of several times. One, she got pulled in pretty hard into an MLM scam. And it was...
Are they all scams?
Well... I don't know. there's some that have legitimate products or whatever. But for her, you know, she'd express that sincere desire to want to... She had played by the rules. And it was time for her to sort of be rewarded for it. And I think when you compare that to early Christianity, which especially it spread through the Roman Empire, sort of spread first with the lower classes, with the slave classes. And it was partly and this is one of the reasons Christianity spread very well with the slaves in the United States. There was a certain message of beautiful heaven awaits. You know, you're in a terrible situation right now, but your reward is on the other side. And that sort of creeped into this life, saying, well, I went to the temple, I had my kids, I did all this, I need to be rewarded now. And I think that idea is strong.
I have two things. If you believe the Book of Mormon and you believe the pride cycle, which I'm assuming that the brethren do you think they're worried? Because in the Book of Mormon, you never, never, never get out of the cycle. Well, they're obviously pretty close to the top. Do you ever think they're going to fall to pride?
Do I think they're going to fall to pride, or do they think they're going to fall?
Do you think they think that they're going to fall to pride?
No, I think Wilfred Woodruff's statement gave the exception to that this church will never fall. You know, when they were concerned about polygamy, and he said, you know, the Lord won't permit me or any other of the authorities to lead the church away, I think that's their get out of jail free card. And I don't think that the brethren believe that that cycle is in danger, that the church in their minds cannot fall into apostasy, ergo whatever they do is okay.
And I think the second thing, where why Mormons are so gullible to schemes, I think it has to do with the priesthood. I watched
many things do.
No, because if you are worthy to hold the priesthood, and if you're worthy to go to the temple, then you must be being honest with your fellow men, and therefore I must be able to trust you. My mother, my dad died about 6 years ago. She got a large life insurance, and it was very quickly scammed by the Elders Quorum president, her ward, who invested it for her. And now she's out hundreds and thousands of dollars, and he's bankrupt. But she trusted him because he was the Elders Quorum president. And when he said, don't talk to your children about this, they won't like it, but trust me because I'm a leader in your ward. And then when push came to shove, and she took my husband, who's a CPA, with her to talk to him to try and get some money back, the weekend of my sister's wedding, she wouldn't let him push, and basically just gave up. And the next day, he sat in the temple with them at my sister's ceiling. I think it all boiled down to, well, he's a good guy because he's my friend, because he's in my ward. And I think that's what it all comes down. It's so sad, but that's what it comes down to, is the priesthood authority of righteousness.
It's sad, but there's a real positive side to it. You know when you clean your kid's room, they're more likely to go in and mess it up, because it's sort of you've swung the pendulum that way, and now it suddenly seems fun. I think that in Mormon circles, people are very trusting, and for the most part, people are very trustworthy. And if you've moved into a new ward, especially outside of, you know, outside of Utah, you'll find that you instantly have family and instantly have people who are willing to take care of you. And I think these guys are sort of parasitical on that thing that's very positive. So I always cringe a little bit as we sort of accuse Mormons of being gullible. I don't think they're gullible. I think they actually have something that's quite beautiful that it's easy to come in and corrupt, and it's easy to take advantage of. And I think that these parasitical guys do that, and they can pull out their temple recommend card and their callings, and unfortunately, that leads to fraud.
At the same time, I think that he felt like, because he was a good guy and he was righteous and he was, that it would succeed. And I think he genuinely felt that way to begin with.
Well, that's
because he's righteous, and so he's going to be blessed by his.
The relative I was talking about, that was part of her reasoning when she got involved with. And hers was a pure MLM. There was no product at all. And it was, well, we, you know, it's our turn to be blessed, you know. She prayed about it, and she thought the blessings were coming.
Yeah, that happened here.
I really enjoyed your presentation. I guess the question I have is, you know, the prosperity gospel seems to be continue to be espoused in the church. But if you read President Irene's address on tithing 2 or 3 months ago, he's very careful to say that these blessings may not be temporal. I think there's a cultural underpinning that if you pay your tithing, you will receive material blessings. And now I'm thinking that members of the church are not seeing these blessings, particularly if you're middle class, lower middle class, and poor. They're not seeing this prosperity gospel. So the churches now have to say, well, if you pay your tithing, you may get these temporal blessings, but you're more like you're going to be blessed spiritually. Which is, I think, is kind of a change to what at least the cultural undercurrents have been.
Yeah, and there's been a recession. You remember those cereals for breakfast cereal? I mean, those commercials for breakfast cereal when we were kids, and they'd say part of a well-rounded breakfast, and then there was a well-rounded breakfast outside of the cereal. And I think that's kind of what's going on. You know, it's sort of like be a good Mormon and go to school and save your money, and you know, and they give all these standard economic things. But you're right. In, you know, in recessionary time periods, I'm sure they see a lot of the backlash of this. So they're always trying to deal with that stuff, but it's an undercurrent. But I mean, these guys are business guys. They know how right. business works, and they know the practicality of it.
And secondly, you have the Bible. You have a mutually exclusive statement that says choose between God or Mammon. And then Doctrine and Covenants says seek after wisdom, and then you know not after riches. So like a mutually exclusive statement. So in your mind, how do the brethren reconcile that? Because you have BYU. So I mean, you're promoting law and business. So these are all inherently maybe promoting riches, but the scriptures are saying something completely different than what we're
I don't know how the brethren reconciled it. I'll tell you how the guy who sits next to me at work reconciled it. Because I asked him that one time, you know, because he's really into Glenn Beck and money, and he's always buying gold and stuff. And I said, you know, Jesus said the thing about the, you know, render to Caesar's. You know, how do you reconcile that? He said, Jesus was giving us a pattern. He wasn't saying money was bad. He was just saying when you're dealing with the monetary realm, you got to deal with the Romans over here. And when you're dealing with God, you deal with God over here. So you can do whatever you want over here, and that's fine. Jesus was giving us permission. He was saying, you deal with the Roman monetary system. Go on. Go do it. So I think for a lot of them, they see them as they're both A-OK.
Thank you.
At least that's what my cube mate says.
I mean, you had a couple of constellations in terms of American exceptionalism and the prosperity gospel, and it seems as though one thing that might be missing would be that if our primary values are righteousness and worthiness, which are totally intangible, and yet we need to know our status. And so I think of the Puritans where, I mean, they could be elect or they could not be elect, and it drove them crazy that they didn't know who was who. And so they then developed systems to say, well, either I'm elect or she's elect or he's elect based on that. So I wonder if the desire for and the accumulation of wealth has to do with some sense, some hint of where we are, because it's so hard to live in this abstract realm, right? That am I righteous or am I not? How do I know? And it seems as though wealth is an appealing hint, perhaps, right? At least that's the way we interpret it, than to say, oh, I'm on the wrong path, or I'm on the wrong path or the bad path. And it just seems as though psychologically, whether we're inside the church or outside, that these intangibles aren't enough for us, that we need some nudge to to help us where we are. What do you think?
No, I think you're spot on. I think you're exactly right. And I mean, I don't mean to be sitting up here on my high horse. If I find the guy I work next to, who I've been working longer, whatever, if he's making more than me, that's going to piss me off. You know, so we use that all the time, that sort of, where are we at and where is our station in line? There's another thing that's sort of related to what you're saying, that the church is really pragmatic in both good ways and bad ways. But, you know, the church does say all the time that all callings are equal. Let's give them the benefit of the doubt. Let's assume that's true, you know. Well, then who do you want being a stake president? Well, if the primary teacher is just as righteous as the stake president, then righteousness is not the differentiator. So who do you want in there? You want the guy who knows how to run a 3,000-person organization. So there is a side that they're just being completely pragmatic, and they are right on, and that maybe just, well, shows who's more elect. I don't know.
Well, just a quick aside, that I'm in education, and in some ways the most valuable things in education are not things we can necessarily assess, mm-hmm. right? But yet we're in the midst of assessment tools, right? And that's what counts. And it seems as though, religiously speaking, we struggle with the same thing, right? I think on the one hand, we absolutely would all agree that righteousness is the most important thing, but yet there's that desire to assess, to quantify, to count, right?
Yeah.
And that often leads to something material. So I guess I'm in some ways sympathetic with that desire to quantify, despite how misguided and, you know, wrong it can be. I can at least understand the desire.
Yeah.
If somebody said, well, do you love me? Well, I'm not going to tell you, right? And I understand that.
Well, and I really like your word on assessment. And I have to remind some of my ex-Mormon friends sometimes to be a little bit more empathetic. You imagine being a 70, and you're flying out to, I don't know, Des Moines, and your job is to put in a new stake president. You don't know any of these people from Adam, right? You've got, like, you fly in on a Friday. You've got till Sunday, 10 a.m., when the stake session is, to appoint the new stake president. Man, that sounds like a hard job to me. And you see a guy who, you know, he's been running a company for 14 years. You know, his family seems to be together. You know, he combed his hair in the morning. You're like, well, you know, he seems to know, everybody else seems to be, and he clearly can do something. You know, so, yeah, he's got a suit on. It's been pressed recently. You know, there's going to be just a natural bias to say, oh, that guy seems to be the guy who can do this. Because running the church the way they do is extremely difficult. Can you imagine running a church without a trained clergy? Holy crap, that's got to be just a nightmare. You know, people will say, what are those guys in the church office building doing all the time? It's always solving these problems from having a lay leadership, in my opinion. And that's why, in my opinion, you're getting CEOs and guys who know how to run businesses in there, because they're trying to solve the key problems that they're running into every day.
I just wanted to share a quick experience that I've had. I have a good friend who moved to Utah just because he wanted to be out west. He grew up back east, and basically when he came here, he was kind of a clean slate with respect to Mormonism. But he's a lawyer, and he also is a licensed securities broker, and he ended up working for the state of Utah in the securities division. And his job is an investigator to investigate securities fraud. And he, every time I see him almost, he's telling me stories about members of the church, usually leaders of, you know, some rank or whatever, that you know, they end up arresting on securities frauds that have, you know, they've defrauded members of their ward or their community, people that they know, and that when they first started this, you know, they go through the person's records and see what they've done with the money, that the ill-gotten gains, and usually a big chunk of it has gone to the church in terms of tithing. And so they started suing the church to recover that money, and now they've gotten to the point where they don't even need to do that. They just present the evidence to the church, and the church mails them a check, and they get it back. But he's become a little bit jaded because of that experience. That, you know, it seems like the Mormon leaders sometimes feel like if they can get away with it, it's okay.
Yeah,
there's no question about whether it's moral or not. It's just, can I get away with it?
When you merge money and religion, you get the trappings of both.
It seems to me that in your comments, in response to the questions that you've had, something that you said leads to a conclusion that hasn't become explicit, that I want to see if you think really is a conclusion that follows from what you said. Because, after all, the people in the church can respond to this respond to this kind of criticism of the prosperity gospel kind of infiltrating the church by saying, well, you know, after all, people who are working class, blue collar, are not, they're not going to have very much flexibility in their working hours. They're usually going to be working in several jobs. They're not going to be able to do the taxing jobs in the church. And the church itself is essentially like a big corporation. And so the people that you're going to want to have run it are also going to, in addition to having more flexible jobs, they're also going to know what they're doing because they know how to run a corporation, right? So essentially, just out of practical concerns, not out of a theology of prosperity, not out of believing that by being righteous you're going to become wealthy, just out of practical concerns, you will end up with the wealthy running the church and the poor being run. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, that's what's going to happen.
Right, right, yeah.
So the conclusion that I draw from that is the solution to that is to get rid of lay clergy. You need to have paid clergy in the LDS church if you want to get rid of that.
That'd be a solution. There's another more creative solution, which is, you know, we talk about divine right of kings. You know, if you go to the King Arthur legends, or virtually any biography of a general authority, they're laying out this pattern of the way they lived that gets them to that position. Right, so if you're selecting the guys who have the most time and money and ability to run, then there's this dark, sinister idea to go in and say, well, you see, God was laying him out there from the beginning, you know, so he was called to be an investment banker.
Yeah, but that's a post hoc justification of what they're really doing for practical reasons.
Right. Yeah, I agree.
And our time is up. Thank you very much.